From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new documentary Comedian, about Jerry Seinfeld's return to stand-up, asks the question, where does comedy come from? On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews from our archives with Seinfeld and two other comedians featured in the documentary, Gary Shandling and Jay Leno. Some laughs for Thanksgiving coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israelis faced attacks at home and overseas today as the right-wing Likud party held its primary. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility for an attack by two Palestinian gunmen in northern Israel that left at least six Israelis dead. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Witnesses said the two gunmen jumped out of a car in the center of Beit Shan and began firing in all directions. One gunman ran toward the central bus station, the other into the local branch of Israel's ruling Likud party, where voters were casting ballots for party leader in a primary election. Witnesses said the attack seemed well planned. Three sons of Knesset member and former Foreign Minister David Levy were injured in the attack, one seriously. It came as voters from Israel's ruling Likud party cast ballots for a party leader. Early results confirmed an overwhelming win by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon over former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Likud party is widely favored in Israel's national election in January. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Also today, suicide bombers killed at least a dozen people at an Israeli-owned hotel in Kenya, and someone fired missiles at an Israeli jetliner as it took off on a flight from Kenya to Tel Aviv. The plane, with 271 people aboard, was not hit. Meanwhile, with exit polls showing him losing today's primary, Israeli Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu conceded to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for control of the Likud party. United Nations weapons inspectors have revisited the site of an Iraqi biological weapons program. The site was a factory for making farm animal vaccines, but more than 4 years ago, inspectors found evidence that it had been used to make deadly toxins. The UN experts declined to comment on whether they found any new evidence today. The head of United Airlines says he'll renew talks with the mechanics union leadership to bring another wage concession proposal to the table. A majority of the mechanics voted against $1.5 billion in wage cuts. Tony Sarabia reports from Chicago Public Radio.
United Airlines machinists remain split on the company's restructuring plan. Two factions of the machinists' union voted in favor of the $1.5 billion in wage concessions, but 57% of the 13,000 mechanics and related employees voted against the measure. The plan would have contributed $1.5 billion in cost reductions to the airline. The head of the mechanics unit of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers endorsed the proposal, calling it the best way to protect the membership's wages, pensions, and benefits while enabling United to avoid bankruptcy. Most other United Airlines union employees have already ratified wage cuts. United says it needs those cuts to receive a nearly $2 billion federal loan guarantee.
This is NPR News. For the first time, the leader of Sri Lanka's Tamil Tiger rebels said his group is willing to give up its claim for a separate state. But the guerrilla leader warns of a return to violence if the government fails to grant more freedom in rebel-held areas. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
The remarks of the Tamil Tiger leader Velupillai Prabhakaran were broadcast by a rebel-controlled radio network in Sri Lanka. He said the Tigers are willing to accept a political solution to the 19-year conflict, a decision that was announced in peace talks earlier this year, but never directly by the rebel leader himself. Prabhakaran said, however, that the current peace process being mediated by Norway must result in substantial concessions from Sri Lanka's government, mainly greater self-rule in the north and east of the island nation dominated by ethnic Tamils, where the Tigers have been fighting for a separate state. He said failure to achieve this goal will force the Tigers to resume their armed struggle. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
Portuguese defense officials denied today that the oil tanker Prestige broke up because a Portuguese warship ordered it into a dangerous position. The German news magazine Stern reported today that tugs pushing the stricken oil tanker were ordered to turn the vessel and take it out to sea. Quoting the captains of the rescue vessels, the magazine said the new maneuver put the tanker between two huge waves that caused it to break up. Portuguese officials said the Navy merely warned the tanker that it could not enter Portuguese waters. The Prestige sank, sending more than 70,000 tons of fuel to the bottom, where environmentalists say it could remain a hazard. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, wishing you a happy Thanksgiving. We have some comedy to help you celebrate the holiday. After the final episode of the sitcom Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld retired his stand-up comedy act on an HBO special. Later, he decided to return to stand-up with all new material, and it wasn't easy. The new documentary Comedian follows Seinfeld as he struggles with writing and performing his new act. He tested it out on audiences at the small comedy clubs where he worked before he was famous, and it was strange to be back. The documentary Comedian also features Seinfeld in conversation with several fellow comics. We'll hear from two of them later in the show, Jay Leno and Gary Shandling. But let's start with a brief interview I recorded with Jerry Seinfeld in 1987, before the creation of his sitcom, when he was still doing the comedy circuit. We started with an excerpt of the act he was doing then. Part of it drew on his childhood experiences growing up in a middle-class family in suburban Long Island. Here he is on the experience of being dragged along by his mother on a shopping trip to buy wallpaper.
You know when you get bored, your feet just kind of start to drag and you just... Mom, can we get out of here already, please? Mom, come on, let's go. They don't have him. The guy talked to the other guy. They don't. No, I don't think they're in the back. I don't even think they have a back here. Let's just get out of here, all right? Just... Of course, when you're a little kid and you get bored, you can't support your body weight at all. You have to really just lie down wherever you are. Your parents, they take you to the bank. That was the classic one. My parents take me to the bank, they turn around from the teller, and I was just flat out on the floor. Just can't make it, Mom. And they get so upset. Would you get up off the floor, please? Get up. I can't get up, Mom. It's too dull in here.
In 1987, I asked Jerry Seinfeld if he ever tried on zany personas when he was getting started in comedy.
When you're starting, you don't know what the hell you're doing. I mean, I would... Let's see, when I was starting, it was 1976, and the elections were on, and I remember I had a line about Scoop Jackson that I thought he sounded like the Baskin-Robbins counterman of the week. And I remember that was one of my big jokes. And I had a joke about, what else did I have? I had a joke about the tramway here in New York being the first ride, that the city was going bankrupt and that they're putting up rides for us and that eventually we'll be seeing, like, roller coasters in the South Bronx, which would be the first roller coasters where people scream on the flat part of the ride.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, but no, I never had any real personas, no. I always, you know, idolized people like Bill Cosby and people that were just themselves. I mean... I think the idea of a comedian is someone that you relate to. I think comedy star is almost an oxymoron. You don't look up to comedians like you look at Madonna or, you know, Elvis or people like that. They're, you know, those are people from other planets. Comedians are people that you go, people come up to me and talk to me, they just use my first name, or they don't even introduce themselves. They just start talking. And that's how you know you're it's working, you know. That's what you want them to feel about you, that you're just someone they know.
Was it difficult at the beginning trying to figure out how to make what was probably a pretty sheltered and comfortable middle-class background really funny to people?
I never think of terms of what's my background or anything. I would just talk about anything that struck me funny.
You have a great bit about how bored you were when your mother used to drag you to wallpaper stores to go shopping. What brought back memories like that?
I saw a kid in a store, and I saw that great kid response where you don't think I shouldn't lie down in public. You think, I'm bored, I'm lying down. And kids just do whatever they want, and they're hilarious to me. But I don't really get it, actually, from seeing kids as much as I actually remember it myself. I remember lying down in the store. I remember begging my mother for a dime so I could sit on a metal horse that vibrates.
When you started doing your material, were you ever worried that your parents would come and hear your act and they'd be a little insulted? We didn't know he was bored when we took him to the bank.
Yes, I was petrified when they first saw me. Well, also because I wasn't really funny as a kid, and I felt like I was, you know, exposing this alter ego, you know. Plus, here I am getting up on stage and manipulating these people, you know, into laughing. It's a power thing, you know, and it's weird to do it in front of your parents. Because in front of your parents, you always want them to have the power. And then all of a sudden, you get up in this, you know, very controlling situation. I mean, a comedian is basically a very aggressive thing to do. You force people to see things your way so powerfully they react audibly. You force them to react, to look at things the way I look at them and laugh at it when I say to.
When you put it in power terms, it becomes a very potentially arrogant thing to say, I'm good enough, I'm going to stand up here and make everybody laugh.
Absolutely.
They can all see it my way.
Yeah.
What made you think that you could do it and that being a stand-up comic wasn't a totally absurd and ridiculous idea?
I didn't think I could do it. I thought this is a totally absurd and ridiculous idea. But that's exactly what I thought. And I said, but I have to try it. I have to try it. Because I thought this is the pinnacle of life to me. If you could do this, you know, if you could stand up on stage and make people laugh, that would be the ultimate accomplishment of my personality. And I just thought laughs, to be working with laughs and jokes all the time, what a fun life that would be.
Did you pay your dues playing bars and clubs where you were totally ignored?
I'm still paying them, Terry.
Are you really?
I worked a club last year where the waitress, to get to her tables, had to step up on the stage and walk between me and the audience. And people think I'm embellishing this story. She had to stand up on stage. She'd walk between me and the audience. She'd get the drink order, back up on stage, back in front of me and the audience. This was in Ohio. Where in Ohio? I can't even remember.
Are audiences more willing to go along with you after they've seen you on TV?
You get a free 90 seconds. When people have seen you on TV and they know who you are. You get up on stage, for the first 90 seconds, I would say, to 3 minutes, they will laugh at just about anything you say, and then it's right back to where you've always been when you were a complete unknown.
So it doesn't help too much.
No, people don't laugh because they recognize you. You know, they do at first, but they don't. It wears off pretty quick. You know, you've got to be funny every night.
How do you work on your routine? You have some ideas, but you've really got to put it together into a good routine, a good bit.
I get an idea, and I think there's something funny about that, and I don't know what it is at first. This is how my stuff usually works. Like, I saw, like, McDonald's having a sign that says 60 billion. And I think, now that's, you know, there's something very funny about that, that a company of that size is still counting every burger. You know, I mean, there's some kind of insecurity there that you're still thinking, how well, are we doing well? We're doing well. Aren't we doing well? Look at how many we've sold, you know. And I don't know, you know, who really cares besides them. And besides which, what is their ultimate goal? You know, if 60 billion is not enough, I mean, do they want cows surrendering, just voluntarily showing up and going, we give up. You've sold so many burgers, we're turning ourselves in. So I don't know. So I look at things, I go, what's funny about that? But like in my show, I talk about Tide being improved. That's a classic kind of joke that I like to do. Now, why would a comedian look at Tide detergent being improved and think that's funny? To me, you know, comedians generally talk about dating or something, but why are they improving Tide? You know, it's just things I have to think about. Does anyone care?
So why are they improving Tide?
It's getting out bloodstains now. And I think if you got a T-shirt with bloodstains on it, maybe laundry isn't your biggest problem. Maybe you ought to get rid of the body first before you do the wash.
Jerry Seinfeld recorded in 1987. The new documentary, Comedian, is about how he created and tested his new stand-up act. He begins a national tour of that act on Saturday. Coming up, comic Gary Shandling. This is Fresh Air. We're hearing from a couple of the comics who are featured in the new Jerry Seinfeld documentary, Comedian. Gary Shandling satirized every aspect of late-night talk shows on his series, The Larry Sanders Show, which is now being rerun on Bravo. Shandling parodied talk show hosts so well because he used to be the real thing. He had been Johnny Carson's regular substitute host, and for a while Shandling was considered Carson's heir apparent. But Shandling gave up The Tonight Show to concentrate on his first comedy series, which was called It's Gary Shandling Show. That was in 1986. Here's a scene from The Larry Sanders Show, with Shandling as a self-involved but insecure late-night talk show host named Larry Sanders. Larry has just finished taping a show and is talking with his producer, Artie, played by Rip Torn.
It's a fine show, not a best of, but a fine, fine show.
The monologue was awful.
A piece of But you're hilarious when you're Bobby.
Well, I've been getting a lot of practice lately. What the hell's wrong with Jerry?
He's a great head writer, but everybody goes through a slump from time to time. Everybody but you, of course.
Oh, shut up.
Great show, Mr. Sanders.
Oh, thank you, man.
Kyle, thanks. Kyle.
Thank you again, Kyle. Who the hell is that?
Kyle.
Oh, I assume, but who the hell is he?
Kyle? He's been our associate director for 3 months.
3 months? We should find out if he has any head writing experience.
I'll check.
I spoke with Gary Shandling in 1992. He was supposed to join us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. But shortly before the interview was to begin, his publicist called to say that Gary had car trouble and couldn't get to the studio. So we did the interview from his phone.
Okay, so you can imagine what went through my mind when I found out that your car wouldn't start. In your talk show experiences, have you ever had that happen where someone doesn't show up and they say their car isn't working?
No, it is the flimsiest excuse, isn't it? It would be better to say my dog ate the car, I mean, or something. It sounds like one of those horrible high school excuses.
when you were guest hosting The Tonight Show, did guests ever, like, not show up for one reason or another? Did you have to do anything to improvise?
I will tell you once that, I never had that, although we are going to do an episode about that. In fact, I think we did an episode where we sort of had that one moment happen where they couldn't get Janet Jackson and she canceled at the last minute, and then T-Bone Burnett came in at the very last second and did it. And we've touched on that kind of stuff where someone drops out, and usually... it's very interesting. Usually, the Tonight Show or the Letterman Show has a list of about 10 people that they can always just call who live within a radius of 10 miles of the studio that will come on in case someone doesn't show up. And so I'm trying to think if I know who it is at the Tonight Show. They'll pick up the phone, for instance, and call Dick Cavett or something and say, you know, you want to come on. And there are always some people who are willing at the last second to come on.
So listen, this talk show, you've done the talk show for real, you know, guest hosting on The Tonight Show, and now you're doing a parody of it. What's the difference, do you think, between Larry Sanders as a late-night host and Gary Shandling?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I actually think that on the talk show part itself, on the Larry Sanders show talk show part that we see live on the air, that is basically me hosting a talk show. That is how I would host a talk show. Larry is very different than Gary as a person, and what we see backstage is not exactly me. Larry is much more driven career-wise, much more competitive career-wise, much more concerned about ratings than I am. Much angrier than I am, and on the air, he is very similar to what I would be like hosting a show. I find myself, since it's a satire of talk shows, doing a few Johnny moves that I wouldn't probably do if it was really me, and doing a few kind of Letterman moves that I wouldn't do.
On some of the episodes, there's a lot of tension between what's happening off camera and what's happening on camera. I mean, there's one in which you're fighting with your wife, you know, kind of backstage, and then you have to keep running back on the air and being really affable. Has anything like that ever happened to you in yours in the time that you really hosted?
That particular thing has never happened. I have been in a relationship where, right before I went on stage, and this is what I took the moment from, it was many years ago, and I was getting ready to go on stage at the Comedy Store, and my girlfriend at the time said, you know, I really want to discuss our relationship. And I said, well, okay, but I'm on in 2 minutes. Well, she said, there's never a good time to talk to you, is there? And we were really having an argument right before I went on stage. And then actually, that kind of thing never stopped. I was hit by a car about 6 months after that, and I was in the hospital with all these tubes connected to me. And she came to the hospital, and I was on the critical list, and she said, I really want to talk to you about our relationship. And I was like on Demerol at the time. And I said, well, you know, if I don't think this is the right time, but anyway, it sounds like I probably was very shut down and not communicative, but I was, and she just picked the wrong time. So we took that element and made a show out of it.
Boy, I hope she wasn't thinking that you would do anything to get out of talking about the relationship. You'd do stand up, you'd get into a car accident, anything to avoid that discussion.
I never thought of it that way. But I guess when I joined the astronaut program,
My guest is Gary Shandling. When were you old enough to stay up late enough to watch The Tonight Show?
Well, you know, I am one of those kids who became aware of comedians at a very early age. It was very odd that at the age of 10, I had memorized the Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, 2,000-year-old man routine, and I was listening to that album, and I used to watch Don Rickles on TV, and I remember staying up late and watching Jack Parr when I shouldn't have been, and Steve Allen when I shouldn't have been. So, starting very early, I was very tuned into the world that I'm in now.
But you ended up in college studying engineering and marketing.
Yes, I was an electrical engineering major for 3 years.
So why did someone who loved comedy so much go into engineering?
Well, you know, I was in Tucson, Arizona. That's where I grew up. And you don't, and my parents are not in the arts. And so it wasn't like when I was 15 or 16, anybody encouraged me to go and be a comedian or to be in show business. And I had no real inputs in that direction. There were no clubs. I remember driving to Phoenix when I was 17 or 18 to see George Carlin work in a small club. That was the first time I'd ever been in a small kind of club before, nightclub. My parents used to take me to Las Vegas where I remember Don Adams was working in Las Vegas.
Get Smart
was
yeah.
popular. And I remember Don Adams telling old jokes. I was like 12 years old, and I went, my God, I thought to myself, he's doing old jokes. How can someone do an act with jokes that are old jokes? I remember thinking that when I was 12 years old, and I was aghast. I assumed that everybody wrote their jokes. I didn't know you could go to a joke book, and that's what a lot of those guys used to do. So I was really tuned into that. And then my second or third year in the engineering department, I got very frustrated. And I sat down with myself and had a soul-searching conversation with myself and said, you know, what I'd really like to do is see if I can write comedy. And I just made a decision then when I was 19 or 20. Well, you know, I was pretty old to move to L.A. after I graduated. I switched my majors and said, I'll see what happens. And I moved to L.A. stone cold, didn't know anybody, didn't know how to go about it, and really started from scratch.
When you started doing stand-up, Did you have a sense of who you wanted to be on stage? You know, like what aspects of your own personality you really wanted to bring out for your stage persona?
It was really a nightmare. I had no idea who I was when I started, and I was frightened to death and had no natural performing skills. I'd never performed before in my life, and to be thrown onto the stand-up stage is an experience that you cannot fathom until you're actually there, because there's no place to go, and everyone's looking at you, and you can't even see them because of the lights. And yet you have to manage to start talking and be funny on top of it. And at the beginning, I think I did. I wrote material that was very much influenced by Woody Allen, who's my favorite. And I used to do very offbeat jokes that sounded like I was reading them. And it took years to develop a style. And actually, what happened is I was involved in a relationship, and the girl left me, and I was very hurt, and I had to go up on stage, and I finally just turned to the audience and said, this girl left me. I said, what happened is she moved in with another guy, so I dumped her, because that's where I draw the line. and so that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of, you know, people of the Gary Shandling dating years in stand-up that came out, you know, because I realized, oh, I started to really spill my guts about being hurt, and people really related to it.
Gary Shandling recorded in 1992. He makes an appearance in the new Jerry Seinfeld documentary, Comedian. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Crimson Petal and the White, a novel of Victorian England by Michelle Faber. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Jay Leno tells us about his years as a struggling comic, doing stand-up in strip joints and sleeping on the steps of comedy clubs. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like just about every young comic of his generation, Jay Leno's early dream was a guest spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. A lot of Leno's friends got their chance before he did, but he's the one who finally inherited the show. Leno is a longtime friend of Jerry Seinfeld and is featured in the new documentary about Seinfeld, Comedian. I spoke with Leno in 1996 after the publication of his memoir, Leading with My Chin. We started with an excerpt of the audio version of the book.
I'm a half-breed of the oddest sort, one part Scottish, one part Italian. The combination makes no sense because each side couldn't be more diametrically opposed. My mother, Catherine, was born in Scotland, and my dad, Angelo, was a first-generation Italian-American. And I seem to be divided right down the middle. My Scottish side, practical, analytical, even a bit frugal. The Italian side, loud, outgoing, ready to laugh and be laughed at. Of course, my mother never really understood the Italian part of my behavior. When I was a boy, she would all scold me, there's a time to be serious and a time to be funny. But in truth, there was never a time to be funny. We could be at Disneyland. My mom would say, not now. Not now, Mom. When am I supposed to be funny? We're at Disneyland. Seems like it's always time to be serious. She would later watch me do my stand-up comedy and make little notes. I'd ask how she'd like the show, and she would say, Why can't you sing a little song and do a little dance? Nobody likes jokes all the time. Nobody wants someone to be funny all the time. The most entertaining spectacle in my youth was to watch both sides of my family try to interact. Each side obviously had totally different attitudes and approaches to life. At the Italian functions on my father's side, there would be hundreds of meatballs for maybe 8 people. More food than anyone could possibly eat. Huge pots, huge portions. My mother's sister, Aunt Nettie, would be incensed by this. Look at the food, Jamie. The food that's going to waste. The waste. If there were more than 2 lights burning in any room, she'd scream, I can't believe it. All these lights. The waste of electricity, Jamie. The waste.
I asked Jay Leno if he remembered the first time he got a laugh from an audience.
The first adult laugh. I remember always doing things. I remember the first thing I ever said that got attention. And I remember I couldn't have been more than maybe 4 or 5, but I remember I was over at one of my aunt's house, and my mom was there, and, you know, all the women were fussing around. There was some sort of get-together going on. In other words, just getting together for coffee or what it was. But it was like me and like 5 women, all my aunts and everything. And I remember saying to my mom, just making this observation. I said, Mom, why do girls have humps like camels? Well, of course, woo, 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 all the women, oh, my God, did you hear what the child said? Woo, I had no idea what I said. But I remember all the women, excuse me, running around, my mom going, oh, for goodness, and hustling me out of the room, and people laughing hysterically. And I'm thinking, what did I say? What did I say? The call? Woo, woo, woo. You know, my aunt, you know, those kind of big women that would fan themselves when they heard something funny. Woo, like this, you know, oh, the child should have heard me say, and I never got an answer to my question, but I just remembered that getting this tremendous reaction. And you know, as a comic, I have a sort of a theory about comedians. They always remember everything that got a reaction, any kind of reaction. Just it's like it makes an etch in your brain, you know. And that was the first thing that ever got a reaction. And then the second time I remember it happening. Was in the 4th grade, and it was a joke. I didn't think it was that funny a joke, but at the time, it was the first joke I think I ever said that sounded like an adult joke. It wasn't just a kid joke. We were in Miss Allen, who was still a great friend of mine. She was my 4th grade teacher, and she's still teaching now. I realize now that must have been like her first year. And she was teaching us about Robin Hood, and, you know, the Sheriff of Nottingham was very cruel. And I remember her saying that when the Sheriff of Nottingham would catch Robin's men, he would boil them in oil. I remember putting my hand up, and I remember saying, well, he couldn't do that to Tuck. And she said, why? And I said, well, he was a friar, you know, just a stupid joke. And it got kind of a laugh, and then I got scolded for it. But I remember later in the hall, I was walking down the hall, and one of the other teachers said, hey, Jay, come here. What did you say in Miss Allen's class? What was the joke you told? I said, oh, they couldn't boil them in oil. He was a friar. Oh, yes. And then another teacher asked me about it. And I said, geez, I like this. You know, this is great, this sort of feeling of influence. This is terrific. And it just always kind of stayed with me.
Was your humor ever considered a behavioral problem?
Yeah, as a kid, I was one of those hyperactive kids. And I was the classic, Jay has the ability, but does not apply himself. You know, if Jay spent as much time studying as he does trying to be funny, I mean, I still have that on my report card from Mr. Simon, my 5th grade teacher, that if I spend as much time studying as I do trying to be funny, I would be a big-time comedian or something like that. And, of course, I hear from Mr. Simon all the time now about, oh, how prophetic he was, and you know. And it just kind of makes me laugh.
When you were starting in comedy, there weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where I think you got like $10.
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at like Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience, you know, because comedy is based on a certain civility. Hi, folks. How are you? You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know.
What material would you do in your
prison?
Just
do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes and they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go there, hi, everybody, how you doing? And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, ah! Ah! And then orderlies would come in. And this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. Say, anybody here from Boston? Ah! Ah! You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating because you realized it wasn't until I performed at like this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. They're crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in. And then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance. And, of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light. And I would just be standing in the darkness, telling jokes. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with these miners' hats on.
My guest is Jay Leno. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Jay Leno. You were probably one of the most hardworking comics in show business when you were getting started, just performing anywhere and everywhere to get experience. But sometimes you get billed, you'd get booked in really inappropriate places. And my favorite story about that is when you were booked, I guess it was in a Catskill resort at a Hasidic, at an Orthodox Jewish resort.
Yeah, there was this.
You were booked as what? Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller.
I was billed as a Jewish storyteller.
What did you do?
This agent in New York would come into the clubs and he'd say, I need a comic this Saturday, pays $50, you know. And I remember one time, before I get that story, this guy sent me up to a job and it paid $100 for the weekend. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, $100 for the weekend. And I remember afterwards, the owner of the hotel came over and said, boy, that was very good. You know, normally we don't like to spend $1,200 on an act, but we really enjoyed you. And I realized the agent took, you know, $1,100 commission out of my $100. You know, it was just a nightmare. Anyway, that was the last time I worked for him. And the first time, he sends me up to the Catskills at the Chaim Resort or something like this. And I said, well, what is it? It's just a nightclub. I said, what kind of, I said, is it mostly, oh, no, go up there. So I finally find this place, and it's all these cabins way back in the woods. And nice people, but it's a Hasidic resort. And I pull in there, and it says on one of these, one of those bad signs, that, you know, you pull on a trailer, and it's got the flashing lights around it, tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller. And I go, so I get there and I walk out on stage and it's all Hasidic, you know, and I don't even speak Hebrew or, you know. And I said, listen, there's been a big mistake. You know, I'm not really a storyteller. I'm not even Jewish. The guy made a mistake. And then this guy, so do your act. Let's see what you do, you know. So I did my, and they were very nice. And, I mean, they were polite. You know, you just, you know, I felt bad for them and they felt bad for me. And they were nice people. It just, it wasn't what they had bought, you know. You know, it was a horrible job.
You know, I think it's funny, in your book you talk about how when you were getting started in comedy, or maybe this was even before you got started, when you were growing up, that comics meant adult guys, usually from New York, usually Jewish, who spoke more to your father than they spoke to you.
That's true. When I was a kid, you had Alan King, you had Rodney Dangerfield, and these guys were always funny, but they always came from the point of view, at least to me, was these kids today with the long hair, you can't tell the boys from the girls, I tell you, you know. And all that was funny. My father would laugh at that. And then I remember seeing Robert Klein and George Carlin and David Brenner and Steinberg, and these guys would come out. And suddenly I noticed I was laughing more than my dad because their humor was coming more from my point of view, especially Robert Klein. He was a guy who was, I felt, like me, middle class, normal parents, not crazy, not rich, not poor, just normal, you know, watched the same TV shows as a kid that I watched. Joked about the same kind of things that I watch. And that was a big change in comedy, at least for me.
So how did you figure out where your material was going to be?
I figured it out from watching those guys. You know, I said to myself, boy, these guys make fun of the same kind of things that I think are funny. These are the same things I talk about with my friends. I mean, prior to them, I don't think you would have seen Alan King come on the Ed Sullivan show and do jokes about Jimi Hendrix. You know, it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen.
No, it would be about Jimi Hendrix mowing his lawn.
Right. Jimi Hendrix with a hair like that, you know. But, I mean, suddenly here were guys on mainstream television talking about things only kids, you know. Now adults buy Rolling Stone albums, you know what I'm saying? But
back in
the 70s, there were adult records, you know, which you had Henry Mancini and Frank Sinatra. And then you had, for the kids, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, whatever. And nobody ever did jokes about the Beatles on mainstream television. These were the first comedians to sort of parody younger people's lifestyles.
You know, we were talking about how hardworking you were as a young comic, just trying out everything that you could, playing every place you could play. When you moved to Los Angeles, you moved there before you had a home, before you had any money. And you often ended up just like sleeping on the steps of the comedy clubs or sleeping in the alleys by the comedy clubs.
I used to get picked up in L.A. for vagrancy. And what the cops would do is they just put you in the back of the car and you just drive around with them on their shift all night. And being a comic, you know, this worked, well, somewhat to my advantage, but actually, no. The first time I got picked up, you know, they'd say, let's move along. Where do you live? I don't kind of live anywhere. All right, get in the car. What do? I'm a comedian. Oh, yeah? Tell us a joke, you know. Then you'd sort of try and come up with every dirty joke you could think of to tell these cops all night. And har, har, that was la-la. And then that worked pretty good. Well, they let me go. But then two or three nights would go by, and the cops would go, hey, are you that comedian guy our partner picked up the other night? Yeah, you get in the car. Oh, those jokes you were telling. So, you know, two or three nights a week, I'd have to ride around until dawn telling jokes to different cops because they would say, hey, if you see that kid on the street, pick him up. He's got some funny jokes.
You used to be very close with David Letterman. I think you used to write for his show.
No, I didn't write for his show. Dave and I used to write for Jimmy Walker on Good Times.
Oh. So it must be very strange to be rivals now and to both have these kind of like publicity machines in front of you and between you, you know, getting between
whatever
relationship
you have. Well,
you know,
it seems like it should be odd. I mean, it seems like it should be more fun to me, but...
More fun than it is?
Well, you know, both these networks have huge amounts of money riding on these things.
Right.
And, you know, the odd thing is when we were losing by less than a rating point. Now that we're winning by less than a rating point. But America has this rather bizarre mentality that there's number one, and then number two is a million miles away, bloodied and beaten into the ground. And it's not that way. Both these shows are extremely successful, and both make a lot of money. If one year one show makes a couple of $1 million more than the other, so what? Who cares? I mean, late night television is better because both these shows are on. I mean, to me, nothing would be funnier than to switch shows one night. I mean, to have Dave walk out on my stage and me walk out on his stage simultaneously would seem like the funniest thing in the world. But, you know, it couldn't happen because, I don't know, networks would go nuts or something. Or, hey, I would love to go on Dave's show and do a What's My Beef segment like I used to do in the early days. But then NBC would say, oh, you, tonight's show ratings will go down that night. We'd have to put a rerun on. The CBS's ratings will be huge. Or vice versa. So you just sort of have this odd kind of standoff thing that goes on, which seems rather silly to me. Because I'm a fan of Dave's show. I watch it probably three or four nights a week. And sometimes I think we had the better joke. And sometimes I think, ah, you know, Dave had the better joke on that one. I mean, what it comes down to is he makes me laugh. And the other thing is, there are only three or four people that you can actually joke about this job with because they're people who have done it. Arsenio Hall, Letterman, Pat Sajak, Johnny. There's only a few people out there that when you bring up a certain phrase or a certain guest that know exactly what you're talking about. And it's odd that we can't all get together and laugh about that the way we used to when we were stand-up comedians.
You strike me as more secure, less insecure than a lot of comics.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty secure that way.
Less neurotic?
No, I'm not neurotic at all, actually. I'm not neurotic at all. I mean, you know, Rich Lewis is a friend of mine, and he, you know, I watch him agonize. You know,
right.
He agonizes over every little thing. What's the joke? You like that joke. You know, Rich will say, here's a joke. He'll tell you the joke, and you go, yeah, it's funny. No, you didn't think it was funny. It was funny. Yeah, how funny was it? It was really funny. No, it wasn't that funny. You're being polite. And this will go on for days. It'll go on for weeks if you let it. And, you know, I said to myself, my God, where does that come from?
So you don't understand neurosis?
Well, I mean, I understand it, and I'm lucky I don't necessarily suffer from it.
My guest is Jay Leno. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Jay Leno.
You're kind of famous for hating vacations, for not liking to not work. You like to work a lot. Is that still true, that you still don't like vacations?
I'm not a vacation guy. You know, I was somewhat dyslexic as a kid, and I always remember my mom saying to me, well, you're just going to have to work that much harder than the other kids to get the same thing. And when you brought up being insecure before, I never thought I was insecure. I just thought I was being lazy. And that may sound silly, but to me, if something didn't work, it didn't work because I wasn't working hard enough. Like when the whole thing with The Tonight Show was going on, is Jay going to be replaced? Is he going to get fired? They're going to replace him with Letterman. Well, obviously 16 hours a day is not enough. Maybe I need to do 18 hours a day. And it worked. You know, I mean, that's what works for me. You know, I never said I was the best. I never said I was the funniest. I just said, I will work at this harder than anybody else. And that seems fair. I mean, that's sort of the American way, you know. I've always been a guy that worked on commission. Even when I was washing cars or had regular jobs, I was never a salary guy. I was always the kind of guy that would say, listen, why don't you pay me by whatever? You know, when I took over the Tonight Show, when I used to go into bars with the $50. If you think it's good, pay me what you think it's worth. And eventually, do you get screwed at the beginning? Yeah, but everybody gets screwed at the beginning. You know, to this day, people say, oh, you're getting screwed. Really? I mean, I do very well. I hosted The Tonight Show. I got the job I wanted. I mean, it's what works for me. And in my mind, if I'm one of those guys, like if I take a, you know, I went to Hawaii once. This was like a nightmare. I was doing a gig in Hawaii, and I had to stay down there like 3 days. And the second day, I'm sitting on the beach, and I look at my watch, 10 o'clock. I'm sitting on the beach for about 4 hours, and I look at my watch, and it's 10:30, and I go, great, my watch broke. The battery's dead. And then I asked them, what time is it? And they said, it's 10:30. And I said, really? I've only been sitting here for half an hour? I thought it was like 2 o'clock. This is like a nightmare. Get me out of here. And, I'm not a vacation guy.
It must be strange for you, knowing so many comics so well and having been in the position of being a young, hardworking comic, really wanting their big break, to now be the guy who could give a young, hardworking comic
a
big break.
Oh, man, it's a nightmare.
And I'm sure you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. On the other hand, you want to have the best show you possibly can. So it's probably a really awkward spot.
No, it's horrible because I used to think, well, now that I'm hosting The Tonight Show, I can go anywhere. But now you can't go anywhere because you walk in and you go, oh, gee, there's Larry. I got to hide. You know, that's what it is. I mean, you know, you have friends that come up to you that, you know, it's when I first got the job, men, women, comedians would come up to me and they go, hey, Jay, you know, Johnny would never put me on, but now you got the show. It'll be great, man. I can come on all the time. And I'd have to say, but, you know, if you weren't good enough to get on with Johnny, it's not good enough to get on with me. You got to make it funnier. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends that way. I mean, it's just there are people that I love dearly as friends, but the material is not strong enough, or maybe it's really old-fashioned, you know. It's just, you know, old jokes about, I don't know, hippies or airline food or whatever it is. And you just say, you know, you got to update the stuff. And they just don't get it.
Jay Leno recorded in 1996 after the publication of his autobiography, Leading With My Chin. Leno is featured in the new Jerry Seinfeld documentary, Comedian. The soundtrack of the film features an interesting collection of jazz and rock. The movie ends with a recording that's very popular in the Fresh Air office, The Warders of March, as sung by the late Susanna McCorkle. It's featured on her posthumous collection, Most Requested Songs. Here it is.
É pão, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É o resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's feeling alone, it's the weight of your load. It's a sliver of glass, it's life, it's the sun. It's night, it's death, it's a knife, it's a gun. A flower that blooms, a fox in the brush. A knot in the wood, the song of a thrush. The mystery of life, the steps in the hall. The sound of the wind and the waterfall. It's the moon floating free. It's the curve of the slope. It's an ant, it's a bee. It's a reason for hope. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of spring. It's the joy in your heart. Eu pe, eu show. É uma estradeira, passarinho na mão, pedra de atiradeira. E uma ave no céu, uma ave no chão. É um regato, uma fonte e um pedaço de pão. É o fundo do poço, o fim do caminho. No rosto desgosto, pouco sozinho. A spear, a spike, a stake, a nail. It's a drip, it's a drop. It's the end of the tale. The dew on the leaf in the morning light. The shot of a gun in the dead of the night. A mile, a must, a thrust, a bump. It's the will to survive. It's a jolt, it's a jump. A blueprint of a house, a body in bed. A car stuck in the mud. It's the mud, it's the mud. A fish, a flash, a wish, a wing. It's a hawk, it's a dove. It's the promise of spring. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the end of despair. It's the joy in your heart. João e José, é um espinho na mão, é um corte no pé. São as águas de março fechando o verão e a promessa de vida no teu coração. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. The stump of a tree, it's a frog, it's a toad. A sigh, a breath, a walk, a run. A life, a death, the rain, the sun. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart. São as águas de março fechando o verão e a promessa de vida no teu coração. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. Resto de toco, pouco sozinho. Pão, pedra, fim do caminho. Resto de toco, pouco sozinho.
Singer Susanna McCorkle. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's holiday edition was produced by Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Boldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From WorldCom, a customer commitment update is now available at worldcom.com/update. And Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hello, Billy. How are you, my friend?
Well, God bless you. I was telling Bill that last night I couldn't sleep, and I got on my knees and prayed for you that the Lord would just give you strength.
LBJ's Secret White House Tapes, Volume 2, is now out in paperback. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with presidential historian Michael Beschloss and listen to excerpts of the tapes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.